association for you is such an important thing because they don't have any need of that at all. Now, once a crisis comes, once there's a problem that's introduced into their life, they may begin then to seek for some of the things that you and I have come to depend on so very much in our own lives. Most of the time, whenever there is a crisis of the sort that I mentioned a moment ago, that is introduced into someone's life, they always turn to some tried and true solutions that have gotten them through in the past. Sometimes they're little shortcuts, sometimes they're little dodges that have bailed us out of trouble before, and sometimes people go and seek out those things. And when those things don't work for them, when they don't give them the relief or the answers that they're looking for to solve the problem that they're experiencing, they may then turn to a friend, or maybe a couple of friends. And that failing, they might become desperate, and they begin to entertain a willingness to open themselves up to consider things that they have never, ever considered before. And in that instance in life, for many people, it's when they first give God a hearing. It's when they first decide, well, maybe I ought to check out what the Bible teaches or what religious people or what spiritually minded people have to offer me. And if at that point there is a Christian near us whom we trust, if at that point in our lives when we run into this kind of crisis and we don't know exactly where to go and what to do, if there is a Christian that we know, somebody that would be willing to help us understand, we sometimes begin to listen with a new level of attentiveness. And we begin to consider things that we've never ever considered before. And for some people, this results in them becoming themselves lifelong disciples of Jesus Christ. I think this process of a crisis bringing an unbeliever to a believer in order to get help with the problems that life has thrown at him has been a process repeated over and over and over again in the history of humanity. In fact, I think from the pages of Scripture, it would be easy to make the case that this is a prime method which God has used to call men and women to Himself. In the Bible story that we're going to be examining tonight, we have, I think, one of those turn to God in a time of crisis kind of episodes where somebody who has not paid any attention to God, they have not had anything to do with Him, they have ignored every precept that He's ever enjoined upon humanity, they have ignored altogether the people that supposedly represent Him. I think in Daniel chapter 2, we're going to see tonight somebody who has never given God a thought, give Him some thought. And it's going to result in a radical change in his life. Last Sunday night, some of you probably, I know, were not able to be with us, but I began a 6-part lesson series from the book of Daniel, the first 6 chapters, that we really just call living faithfully in a faithless world. And that first lesson from Daniel chapter 1 last week was based on the events there, and we call that Never Compromise Your Faith. You remember the study that we made about Daniel and his 3 friends there? And we saw in that lesson that the world makes an attempt to try to compromise us. And we use the word homogenize, in fact, to describe what the world does to try to make us just like them. But tonight we're going to be looking at how we help faithless people come to God. And I do believe that that's the emphasis of chapter 2. It occurred to me as I was studying through Daniel chapter 2 a few years ago that the only time I ever heard Daniel 2 discussed was when somebody dropped into the middle of the chapter and came down to about verse 31, and they began to give us the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed, and Daniel's interpretation, of course, of that dream and how that corresponded to various world empires that were coming on the horizon, and how that ultimately there was a kingdom that the God of heaven would set up which would never, ever be destroyed. And quite honestly, I thought that was all that Daniel 2 was about. But Daniel 2 is about far more than that great kingdom that God is going to bring. And in fact, I think that with the information that we gather tonight, that section of the chapter becomes even more impressive to us and helpful to us as we understand that God does have in His mind the idea of ruling over the kingdoms of men, and that He has a kingdom into which we have been called, for instance. As we've already noted, often an unbeliever's first serious consideration of his Maker comes when they are down on their luck. It comes when they are at a time of crisis. And in the case that we're going to be looking at tonight, it is the king of Babylon, 600 years before Jesus was born. A man by the name of Nebuchadnezzar found himself in a position he did not want to be in. He had this crisis. He had this dream that to him was, I guess, a nightmare. It was something very, very troubling to him. And so we begin this text tonight in the first verse with this rattled king, this person who doesn't understand things that are happening to him. In verse 1 it says that in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. That word troubled in the original language means to be beaten or to be compelled or to be pushed. This was not just an ordinary dream. It was the kind of dream you have, and I have. You ever had one that makes you just sit up in the bed? I mean, it is so real and it is so frightening to you that you wake up in a sweat and you're wondering to yourself, now, was that real? You know, and you begin to try to get a hold of yourself because this was so realistic, this dream that you had. I mean, your heart is pounding and your eyes are wide open and you're utterly terrified. That's the kind of dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And he couldn't go back to sleep. In fact, the plural word dreams is right there in verse 1, which means he had this often. This did not just happen one time. These dreams kept coming, and he did what all people do when they hit a situation that they cannot control. Well, he turned to his familiar, tried and true solutions first. The king gave orders in verse 2 to call in the magicians, to call in the conjurers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. And so they come in and they stand before the king. And the king tells them, he said, I have a dream, or had a dream, that my spirit is anxious to understand. And the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic and said, O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants and we will declare the interpretation of it. Now get ready, because the king is about to put these men to a test that will expose the limits of their power. Because in verse 5, the king replies to the Chaldeans and says, the command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. Do you see what he's asking for? He doesn't just want them to rattle off some interpretation of these facts. He wants them not just to give the interpretation of the dream. He wants them to tell him what he's been dreaming. You tell me the dream itself, because without some sort of supernatural power, it's going to be impossible for these men to be able to pull that off. And so in verse 6 he says, but if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore declare to me the dream and its interpretation. Well, as you can probably imagine, it didn't take very long for these Chaldeans and magicians and conjurers to decide we're in deep trouble. Because he's wanting us to tell what he's been, not what it means, he's wanting us to tell him what his dream actually was. And so in verse 7, they answered a second time and they said, no, let the king tell the dream to his servants. They beg him to expose the dream. And we'll tell you what that dream means. We'll give you the interpretation. And the king replied, I know for certain that you're bargaining for time, inasmuch as you've seen that the command from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there's only one decree for you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. And so the Chaldeans answered the king. And look at what they say. They say, there's not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this
of any magician or conjurer or Chaldean. You know, that's a revealing statement that they make there. They're exposing the limits of their ability. They are saying that this is something we don't know how to answer. These are the wisest men in His kingdom, and they are telling Him, there is no earthly solution to your problem, O King. This was the best the advanced wisdom of their day could produce. Don't think that we can do much better than this, though, because I don't think there's anybody that would be able to do this today either, do you? I don't believe anybody would have that ability to do what He is asking them to do. But He knew that if He asked them just to tell Him what the interpretation of that dream was, that they'd probably lie. They'd just make something up. They'd just come up with something they thought He might want to hear. And He didn't want that. He wanted the truth out of them. And so He put them to this test. Well, look at verse 11. In verse 11 it says, "Moreover, the thing which the king demands," they said, "is difficult. There's no one else who could declare it to the king except God, whose dwelling place is not with mortal man." I guess there's not anything surprising to you and me about this declaration, because most of us have at some point in our lives already come to the point where there are times that men just don't have the answers. I mean, you can go to the Texas Medical Center, but there will come a time when somebody down there who's the brightest and the best and the most well-known in the world will have to look at a patient and say, "I just don't know. I've gone as far as I can go with this. I know nothing else that can be done." Men are limited. We are not gods. They recognize that the kind of thing that He is asking of them is something that only a deity would be able to fulfill. And there comes a time in the life of every person when we realize that we cannot just get off easy, that we can't sidestep or ignore the problem or dig ourselves out of our own predicament. We find ourselves in trouble. And sometimes we've had to say, "The only thing that can save me is God. The only thing that's going to be able to get me out of this situation is somebody besides man, because man doesn't have the power to deliver me." And it may very well be that some of the people that you know, some of the unbelievers that you are associated with on a daily basis, will at that moment give the possibility of a supernatural being who transcends human ability. They may give that thought some relevance. And they may, for the first time in their lives, say, "Well, I wonder if there is something to this matter of God. What would God say? What would God tell me about this circumstance?" A number of years ago, I read a fellow who quipped that there were three things that were hard to do, and one of those things, he said, was to climb a fence that was leaning towards you. Think about that. Some of you hunters, you ever been out in a field somewhere and you come across a fence and it's just about falling over, but it's falling over towards you? It's awfully hard to climb a fence that's falling in towards you. He said, secondly, I'll tell you that one of the things that's absolutely impossible to do is to kiss a girl that's leaning away from you. He said, that's hard as climbing a fence that's leaning towards you. But the third thing that's absolutely difficult to do and nigh impossible to pull off is to help somebody that doesn't want your help. And Nebuchadnezzar needs some help. He's come to the extent of human ability here. He doesn't know what this dream means. He's called in the brightest and best. He's asked everybody that he can think of to give him some information upon which he can operate, and he does not get the answers that he needs. And that's how it is most of the time when we're dealing with unbelievers. They don't want to be helped, but occasionally there'll be somebody that'll say, "Well, I've tried everything else. I've talked to everybody that I can talk to. You're a spiritually minded person. You're a person that goes to church. You're a person that reads the Bible. You're a person that claims to live your life by faith. So how do we respond when faithless people ask us for help?" First and foremost, I want all of you to be thinking with me here. I want you to realize that unbelievers do come to you. You've had that happen, haven't you?
on some scale or the other, we've all had unbelievers who tested us, who wanted to know, what's your faith about? Why is it that when you got the news that you had some bad health issue, you didn't just fall to pieces? Why is it that when death came to your family, you didn't just turn over and die yourself? Why is it that when financial losses mounted and everybody was losing their shirt, that was not the thing that defined your life? What is it about you that is different than what is the case with most other people? Believers do come to us when they find themselves in times of crisis. I know of some people that are doing that right now, right here. You know, there was a popular slogan years ago. I think it came out of that old movie about the baseball guy that says, if you build it, they will come. You remember that? And what I'm suggesting to us tonight is that if you build an authentic, consistent Christian life for yourself, unbelievers will find you. And when they find themselves in a crisis and they don't know what to do about it and they've exhausted the limits of all of their knowledge and all of their resources, they're going to be looking for somebody who can help them. And let me say this to you. God's going to see to it that that happens to you as a believer. It's probably been, I don't know. I'd have to stop just for a minute and really calculate it to be accurate. It's been over 15 years ago, probably 17, maybe 18 years ago, that a man right here in Houston, I met him. He attended services. And because of his social position in the community and because of his financial wealth and because of his marital circumstances, I did not expect that he would be interested in the Lord. But that just shows you what I know. That was an assumption that proved to be very, very wrong. Because one day he came and he told me that he wanted to obey the gospel, and so I helped him in obeying the gospel, and it wasn't too long after that we had some private gatherings together to study and to sort of help ground him in the faith, and I got to know him well enough and felt comfortable enough with him and he with me that I just asked him. I said, Roy, I want you to tell me about what has brought you to this point in your life. This is an abrupt change from where you've been all of your life. Why all of a sudden are you interested in these spiritual things? And he looked at me. I won't ever forget what he said. He said, Mark, he said, everybody has got something in their life that's not working. And I stopped to think about that a minute, and I thought, that's pretty wise. All of us have got something that's not working. I mean, it might be a screen door at home that just squeaks all the time, you know. It might be a commode that leaks, and we're tired of that, but it just leaks, and there's just a problem with that. We've put up with it, and we've lived with it. I'm not talking about those kinds of issues. But what he is saying to me is, he said, there are some things in life that just don't work the way they are. And to me, it was a pretty startling admission, because prior to that, I thought that certain people in successful positions didn't have those kind of problems, or at least they wouldn't admit them. I mean, he had a beautiful wife. He had all the money a man could want. He had a great and successful business in the community. He played golf 4 or 5 times a week. I mean, he had that much leisure time that he could do that. And he just did all kinds of things that I thought anybody would want this man's life. Anybody would trade places with this particular guy. But as successful as he appeared to be, he admitted his sins and he obeyed the gospel. You know what that taught me? It taught me that you never really know what is going on in the life and in the thoughts of an unbeliever until a crisis brings it out into the open. And he'd had a crisis that made him come to the point, health-wise, that he needed to give attention to his soul. And I've thought about that ever since, that I need to be aware and to realize that when people are having a crisis, they'll seek out believers. They'll look for somebody that can give them some help. Well, God provides Nebuchadnezzar with a teacher here. With the things that we've said so far in mind tonight, doesn't it seem reasonable that God, who is seeking lost men, would step in to provide a teacher to help a person like that? And this day it was Daniel. Daniel's going to be the answer. Daniel, who is a very faithful and very believing man, is going to be the one
who's going to help this unbeliever in his crisis.
But you know, I look in the Scriptures and I find that there were other people that were looking for the truth. And what did God do? He made sure they got in contact with it. Here's an Ethiopian. He's a treasurer. He's traveling home from being in Jerusalem. He's reading the Bible and he doesn't understand what he's reading. And what in the world does God do except provide for him a teacher in the person of Philip? And so that God would provide a teacher is no surprise, but what is surprising to me is how he goes about it sometimes. Now I want you to think carefully with me because that's what we're going to see next. Look here at verse 12. Because of this, because these fellows didn't help him out, because he got no help from the magicians, conjurers, and Chaldeans, the king became indignant and very furious, and guess what? He flies off the handle, kind of, doesn't he? He gives orders that all of the wise men of Babylon should be destroyed. I mean, if these guys aren't going to help me when I need them, what good are they? Why keep them on the payroll if I'm not getting anything out of them when I need it? So he says, what good are wise men? Let's get rid of all of them. If you've ever heard or made the statement, God works in mysterious ways, you're going to recognize the truth of that here, because those words, let's destroy all the wise men of Babylon, would that not include Daniel and his three friends? They're among the wise men of Babylon. And the king's edict amounted to a death warrant for Daniel. And so I have to stop and say, now what is God up to here? This seems to be working against getting Daniel to teach Nebuchadnezzar and to help him out. So in verse 13, the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain. And yes, Daniel's on the list because they look for Daniel. They look for Daniel's friends and they're going to kill him. Doesn't it seem a bit strange that God would use a death warrant and the fear that it would provoke in the minds of Daniel and his friends to bring a student and a teacher together? That seems odd to me that that's the way God would do it, and yet that's the way God did it. Here's what I want us to learn from that. Don't ever think, Mark needs this badly, don't ever think that the difficult circumstances in your life are without God's purpose in the scheme of things. You may not see it and you may not understand it. And you may loathe the idea that these difficulties are things that you're having to shoulder. But in God's scheme of things, they could very well have great purpose. And we will see here that God can even turn a threat to your physical life into a blessing. He can take a threat to your physical life and turn that into a spiritual opportunity. Daniel gets word. He hears about this edict from King Nebuchadnezzar. And when the king's soldiers knocked on his door, let me tell you, he was ready. Look at verse 14. It says, then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? And Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Those words right there in verse 16 that say that he requested of the king that he would give him time are probably better translated the way the New American Standard Version reads there in the margin, where it just simply says that he requested that he would appoint a time for him. What Daniel is doing is asking for an appointment. That's what he's doing. He's asking, can I have some time? I need to talk to the king. Would the king give me 15 minutes? Can I get on the king's schedule? I want to visit with the king. I want to talk to the king. We saw back in verse 8 that the king had already denied the Chaldeans additional time to collaborate. What Daniel is discreetly and wisely asking for here is just an appointment. Do you know what Daniel doesn't do? Daniel hears about this edict from the king that all the wise men have got to die. He doesn't just stand there like a dumb ox and say, okay, come kill me. He's not just like an animal ready for the slaughter, oblivious to what's going on around him. Daniel did the second thing that we need to do when faithless people come to us in a crisis, and that is we need ourselves to take the initiative to teach them with
discretion and discernment. Now, before I elaborate on that point, did you recognize what I did not say? I did not say that when an unbeliever is coming to you, when a faithless person is talking to you, that the first thing you need to do is call the preacher and turn that unbeliever over to him. Don't do that. That unbeliever doesn't know your preacher. He knows you.
Now, at some point in time, I'll be very happy to help you. And I'll be happy to help you initially. But he didn't come to me. He doesn't know me. He knows you. He knows your faith. He knows what you're about. He's seen enough in your life to say, hey, this guy's got something on the ball. He's got some answers. Maybe I can talk to him. I'll be happy to talk to him. But may I remind you, that unbeliever knows you. And you may be thinking, well, what on earth could I tell him? Here somebody's got a big, big, big problem. What am I going to say? Well, you could start by just telling him what a difference faith in God has made in your own life. And you could promise to pray for him. And I mean, do it. And if he sees the need for salvation at that point, you could have a few verses handy and show him what he needs to do. He may not yet be to that point. You could enlist a few other Christians to help you pray for him. You could spend time with him. You could encourage him to hang in there. You could tell him, don't give up. I'm concerned about you. You could call him on the phone. You could check up on him. There's a lot of stuff you can do when that unbeliever has turned to you and he needs some help with this problem. What I'm saying here is to look at what Daniel did. And Daniel used discretion and discernment, the text says, to teach this unbeliever. And I hope that you're recognizing that God does things this way. This may be a new thought to some of you tonight, but let me recognize that the God of heaven is alive and that He is active and that He is involved in the affairs of your life, in the affairs of my life, in the affairs of this world. And when we recognize that sometimes God allows crises into the lives of unbelievers so that they will seek Him, and that He uses believers like you and me to deliver His message to them, then I can move forward enthusiastically knowing that God is with me, and that whatever ineptness I may feel when somebody comes to me and I say, I just don't know what to say, God's going to help me. I'll be able to provide exactly what that person needs. Daniel knew that the king's life was spinning out of control. He knew that God was more powerful than any man. He knew that God was greater than any circumstance. No, he did not use the occasion to start preaching to Arioch about his sins. In verse 14, he replied, the King James says, with counsel and wisdom. The New American Standard there says, with discretion and discernment. And we must use those things when we approach unbelievers. It is important how we approach them. We've got to be cautious and we've got to be careful. We've got to give them what they're capable of taking as far as the medicine is concerned, little by little by little. You can't just give them the whole dose at once. I remember one time a boy was reading a high school textbook and he ran across some terminology he didn't understand. He read a phrase that said something about diplomatic phraseology. And he said to his dad, who was sitting in the room, he said, Dad, what does diplomatic phraseology mean? And the father said to him, he said, well, son, he said, let's say that you've got this homely girl that you're going out with. He said, you could say to her, you know, you got a face that would stop a clock. But he said, that wouldn't be very wise. He said, but you could say to her, that when I look at you, time stands still. He said, that's diplomatic phraseology. He said, there's a better way of saying that. And his point, of course, was is that you have to be cautious about how you respond. You got to use good words. You got to use discretion. You've got to use discernment. And when an unbeliever is calling for help, it's not the time to go out and beat him up with your Bible. It's not the time to go out and club him with the truth. Yes, Scripture is ultimately important, but remember, you're dealing with an unbeliever. You've got to use discretion. You've got to use discernment. And I believe those two qualities are probably the most effective characteristics of anybody that's going to teach somebody else. Discretion and discernment go a long way in getting the job done. Now, of course, we should not ever have to face situations like this alone. because it would be great to have some help along this line. And in verses 17 through 19, when Daniel finds this situation presented to him, he goes to his house and he tells his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah about the matter, so that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And so the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. And Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And that brings me to the third thing we can do when an unbeliever comes to us. And that is that if you've got somebody at work or somebody in your neighborhood or somebody in your family or some friend from high school or wherever it is that's run into hard times and he's come to you and you don't know what to do, you do the best you can. But I'll tell you one thing you better do. You'd better say to the people here, hey, I need y'all to pray for him. I do not take it lightly. I don't think anybody here takes it lightly. When you come, and this often happens, and you say, so-and-so that's a cousin of mine, or so-and-so that's a neighbor of mine, or so-and-so that's a workmate of mine, is having this problem or that problem, would y'all please put them on the list and pray for them? I don't think that's too tedious. I think that's exactly what I would want if I were a person out in the world. I'd want godly people praying for me. As a godly person, I want godly people praying for me. So if a person is struggling, it's not a bad thing at all for us to enlist the help, to solicit the support and help from other Christians. And in this case, we're talking about prayers that led ultimately to answered prayer from God. You saw what happened there with Daniel and his three friends. They prayed to God about this together. What are we going to do? Can you do something, God, that would keep Nebuchadnezzar from taking our lives? We don't want to die. Is there some way that Daniel and these three friends, as they beseech God, could do something that would get Nebuchadnezzar to change his mind? They saw that they were just tools. And we need the strength to do what we have to do. And soliciting support from other believers and from God our Father is something that we have to do. But let's look again to see what happens. Because in verses 19 through 28, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Daniel blesses the God of heaven, and Daniel said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to Him. It's He who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings. He establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is He who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with Him. To You, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for You have given me wisdom and power. Even now, You've made known to me what we requested of You, for You have made known to us the king's matter. So Daniel goes into Arioch, the guy that came to arrest him, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and he spoke to him and he said, don't destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king. I will declare the interpretation of the king. And Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. He said, I found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. And the king said to Daniel, whose Babylonian name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I've seen and its interpretation? And Daniel answered before the king and said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and He has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your head while on your bed. Who got the glory for all this? Do you see this? All those wise men, you know, they came in. And they said, well, we are the wisest, but we can't tell you the answer. And in fact, a person would have to be deity to know what you're asking for. What does Daniel do? Does Daniel say, wow, this is my opportunity to shine. I can come in and I can mop up here because I can show them things that these other wise people were never able to show them? No, I'll tell you what Daniel did, and it's what we ought to do. He passed on the praise for whatever came as a result of this to God. It's a heady experience when God uses you to make a difference in the life of an unbeliever. You ever had that experience? Am I talking tonight to people who know what it's like to have had somebody that was an unbeliever and because of your work with them, because of your teaching them, they obeyed the gospel? I mean, if you're not careful with that, that could make you think, I'm pretty good at that. Look at what I was able to accomplish. The temptation that comes at the point of converting somebody to the Lord is to take the glory for yourself. And that would have been an excellent opportunity for Daniel to get advancement in the kingdom, you see. He could just claim to have power and special abilities that those other fellows didn't have. But Daniel realized his purpose was to glorify God. It was not to glorify himself. And in doing that, ultimately, God would honor him. And I'm reminded of that familiar passage in the New Testament that says, if we humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He will exalt you in due time. So, there's no room for pride and arrogance here. We just need to do what we're called upon to do the best we know how and give God the glory for whatever happens. Have you come to your place in your maturity as a Christian where you're willing to pass on the praise for anything you might accomplish to God? And you leave your advancement in the ranks of life all up to Him. You know, Daniel did tell him the dream. And he did tell him the interpretation. That's the last part of Daniel chapter 2 that you're well familiar with. And he gave him all the information that he needed in order to, at that time, spare these wise men from the fate which he had declared. I mentioned a few minutes ago that several years back I baptized a fellow that was going along through life, I thought, quite well. And then he told me that there are just things in your life sometimes that aren't working. And I want to close our lesson tonight on that very point. Everybody has got that going on. There's something in our lives that if we could do it differently or do it better, we'd do it. You may know what that is. And everybody faces the reality of a crisis. Somewhere along the line, it's going to be you in the emergency room. Somewhere along the line, it's going to be you at the funeral home. Somewhere along the line, it's going to be you in the unemployment line. I mean, those kinds of things are life. That's what happens to everybody. Everybody's got a need somewhere, regardless of how together they seem to be. It was true of King Nebuchadnezzar, and guess what? Daniel was there. It's true of people right in the sphere of your influence. There are people that have been watching your life, and you didn't know it, but they were doing it. They have been listening to your words for weeks, maybe months, maybe even people you've known for years have been hearing what you've said. They've been watching what you're doing. And one day when they hit a wall they cannot pass over, they may very well, in their faithlessness, come to you. And when they do, you need to be ready, because if you've built a credible record of Christ in your own life, they will come. And God will use you, as He used Daniel on this occasion, to help a man learn the truth. We're going to study more about Nebuchadnezzar later, but the bottom line is, for anybody that might not be back later, Nebuchadnezzar became a believer in the God of heaven. He did something no other Babylonian king before him or since that time did. He acknowledged that the God of Daniel was the God of creation. What a wonderful thing that was for him. And how blessed we would be if that kind of thing could happen to us. If you're here tonight and you need help with some spiritual issue, we stand ready to try to help you. Not as people superior. Not as people who've got it all figured out. Not as people who have everything together. But as people who have struggled as you may struggle. Who may have had some successes that you've not had. Who may have failed just like you failed. And have found the strength through brethren and through the Lord and through the Word to be able to put our feet back under ourselves and get up and walk and do what we ought to do. If you're here tonight and there's some help we can be to you in that way, let us know. If you're not a Christian, it's time for you to be one. This is the evening that you could put on the Lord in baptism and leave the building tonight, saved from your sins, and be given an inheritance among those that are sanctified. We'd like to see that happen if it can, while together we stand and while we sing. Word depart and...